The theme tonight and this month is the heart quality, the parami of wisdom. Right? How many people have heard a talk or reflection on wisdom this month already? Great. So you're already cooking. You're already cooking. Right. So wisdom is really at the heart of our practice. So a lot of the teachings and practices revolve around this quality of wisdom. Wisdom is at the beginning of the Eightfold Path, the first two folds. It's one of the five faculties, and it's right there in the meaning of Vipassana meditation, which means sight into, or the ability to see clearly and deeply how things actually are. This capacity that we have to see kind of beneath the surface spin into more deeply into the nature of things, not just so we become a wise and clever being, but this is a wisdom that is said to change our relationship with what we experience. It's said to free us from constriction, contraction, and clinging. So this is a kind of understanding that disentangles, that frees. And I really appreciate wisdom as a parami, because usually wisdom has quite a sort of privileged position when we're practicing, and sometimes it takes a little bit of like remarketing of some of the other qualities to bring them up to equal par with wisdom, right? Like kindness and patience. But with the paramis, wisdom is one of the ten. Yeah, it's one of the ten. So it supports all the other factors, all the other qualities, and as we're cultivating each other quality, wisdom also grows. Okay. So Thich Nhat Hanh says that wisdom is a verb. Right? Wisdom is a verb. It's not a thing that we get. It's a natural capacity that we have that is available in any moment of experience. It's a capacity, with all of the paramis, it's a capacity that we can access at any moment. So it arises out of when mindfulness becomes more continuous, more regular, when it gains momentum, we gain a greater capacity to discern what's actually happening. So wisdom arises out of our natural capacity to discern differences in things, right? To be able to tell if it's hot or cold. Yeah. Am I sleepy or agitated? Yeah. Is the room light or dark? Yeah. Is this the chair or my foot? Right? Our capacity to discern difference in things. So when we turn this capacity towards our own heart mind, it becomes invaluable. Right? It means that we can come close to the texture and the nature of our experience. Right? Am I, is this heart mind right now affected by wanting, by not wanting? What is the felt difference between those two? What's the difference between generosity naturally arising and feeling codependent? Yeah? More a need to be needed. This discernment can start to tell in the moment, what is that difference? So we can access it in a moment And also through repeated practice, this ability deepens over time. It grows and strengthens over time. We understand more about how the heart-mind operates, what gives rise to what. Yeah. How do things, what conditions support certain states of mind coming into being? And what is the effect of certain states of mind, attitudes of mind? So what is the, what helps things arise? What supports their arising? What supports their ceasing? What kind of trail do they leave? So all this comes under that, this faculty of discerning, understanding, right? So it's not an accumulation of knowledge or facts or cleverness, right? It's a discerning quality. So the images that are used for wisdom, there are many. One is like a sword that cuts through the fog, the thickness of delusion. It has this cutting through. So when we're really swirling or stuck in something, the ability to ask, what's at the heart of this? And I'll talk a bit about questioning tonight, but this questioning or inquiry, what's at the heart of this, can be like a sword that cuts through the spin and the fog of delusion. Wisdom is compared to a lamp that illuminates. So suddenly we can see what was previously kind of obscured. But more than that, we can start to understand what's actually happening. So that understanding at times can happen in a moment, in a flash. It can happen like, also compared to like the sun slowly dawning, like the sun rising slowly in the morning, like a gradual kind of dawning of greater understanding. So sometimes, especially in this practice, this insight meditation, we can be kind of perched and waiting for big breakthrough moments, like flashes of insight, the bolt of lightning that's going to penetrate and dispel delusion forever. At times it can happen like that. We can have a shift in a moment that changes our way of perceiving. But it can also be a slower, less dramatically discernible process of a shift or a transformation in view. So these are all kind of images for wisdom. It's also talked about as a flower that kind of opens, reveals its layers, reveals itself when the conditions are just right. So in some forms, wisdom can feel like something that we kind of will ourselves to kind of crack apart or force open. But some of these images, I think, are really helpful in that it can be a much gradual, more receptive approach, which I'll talk about a little bit tonight. It's not always thunder and lightning. Okay? So our question, or what we hold when we're contemplating a parami, is how does wisdom develop? How does it deepen? How does it grow? And one way that it grows is by asking the right kinds of questions. So there are many ways that it develops, but tonight what I'd like to talk about a little bit or point to is how we might ask, what happens when we ask a question, hold a question in mind. It engages our interest, our curiosity, engages awareness in a different way. So Ajahn Suchito, who wrote this beautiful book on the Parami, at the time that I first received his book, someone also sent me this package of Parami cards based on the book. There are 10 little cards, one for each quality. And on the back of each one, so it gives a little description or definition, and on the back of each one it says, pause, in capital letters. Pause. What is important now? What is important now? Okay. So one way that delusion or forgetting operates is that we forget. We kind of forget what matters, right? We kind of forget what it is that we're involved in. So by asking a question like this, what is important now? It refreshes awareness. It gives us the chance to put something, to remember what we want to place at the center. So this is a question that we can ask repeatedly. What is important now? What is important to bear in mind now, to bring into the center of my awareness right now? So another way of thinking about this in terms of what's important and what we might bear in mind is that the process of awakening, and just by its very nature, is said to be like waking up from a dream. Right? So that's another image that's used. It's like waking up from a dream. We all know that experience. So this reality that is so often dominated or obscured by our kind of attitudes, our views, our judgments and opinions, can be like a kind of, one teacher calls it, like a consensus trance. Yeah. So we may not have the exact same version, but it can, when we start to practice mindful awareness and bring this faculty of clarity, of discernment to the foreground, we can experience a lot of our judgments, assumptions, beliefs, conclusions start to at least fade into the background for moments. And in those moments, it is like waking up out of a dream, right? Or have you ever had the experience of being in a movie theater, right? Being completely immersed in the story of the movie. Like we pay good money to be completely immersed in a story, even if it's a terrifying story, right? And then there is that moment where we remember, oh, it's just a movie. Yeah, I'm here. I'm sitting in a chair, right? We may have the emotions, as though we may have very real emotions, heart beating, anxiety, fantasy, wonder, all of that. But there's that moment of remembering and waking up. Oh, it's just a movie. Right? So it's not that what we're experiencing has no inherent existence. It does have existence. It does have consequence. It does have effects. It does have a reality. But when we are wrapped up in our kind of narrative, our story, our opinion, our judgment of it, it is like being trapped in a dream, and then experiencing the emergence out of that dream. So this process, again, is not like acquiring something. It's more like letting go of something. It's more like emerging out of something. So Steve Armstrong, who many of you know, senior teacher in this tradition, several years ago made up a list of the paramis, just a one sheet, as practices of letting go. Paramis as 10 practices of letting go. So tracing each one as something we might let go of. And so some of you might know that this list is a poster in the bathroom at Cloud Mountain Retreat Center. So when there's nothing left to read, nothing left to think about or gnaw on, here, as you're sitting in the bathroom, are the 10 practices of letting go. Yeah. So this is interesting. In this way of thinking about the paramis, renunciation, he says, is letting go. So renunciation precedes wisdom. He says, renunciation is letting go of prejudices, views, and opinions. So let's say, be willing to let go of our attachment or our complete belief in the reality of prejudices, views, and opinions. And in doing that, that allows the emergence of wisdom, right? Which he says is a letting go of willful naivete, delusion, and the ignorance of I'd rather not know. Yeah. Right? Can you feel that? There are some movies we'd rather not emerge out of. Yeah. And some, even if they're unpleasant or uncomfortable, we're not sure about what the alternative is. Yeah. It's a familiar story, a familiar plot line, a familiar system of references that feels a lot more known than the alternative. Yeah. Okay. So it's not so much that we do wisdom. Yeah, but what we can do with all of these is investigate and examine all the ways that we center ourselves in any given moment and kind of start to spin. You know, there's the experience often of sort of a spiral-like or a kind of like a centrifugal force of our thinking, of our views and opinions. So as we start to comment, defend, complain, narrate, judge, there's kind of a momentum around that that we can discern, we can start to feel, this is the spin. Yeah, this is the spin. We can start to discern, this is what's actually happening. These are like the primary colors of this moment, this moment's experience. Yeah, sensations, the feeling tones, awareness. And this is my story about it, my comment about it, my judgment about it. So that difference is crucial. We can start to kind of pick up on like a long-running kind of complaint or argument with reality in the background. You noticed? The teacher Byron Katie says, when you argue with reality, you lose. but only 100% of the time. Yeah. Okay. So wisdom arises. So this is what we do when we practice mindful awareness. Right? We get in touch with these faculties in a more immediate and direct way. We understand how it is that we get drawn in, caught up, captivated. How does that actually happen? What's the draw? And how do we emerge from that? So the first step in all of this, I want to talk about kind of three models, just briefly, three models that can kind of help us understand this process of kind of waking up from the dream, but also how we might engage questioning in a fruitful way. So three ways that we might be able to relate to asking very fruitful questions that kind of can cut through to the heart of what's going on. So the first of these is you think about a scientist, you know, how a scientist engages with reality or what it is that they're involved with, their area of study. Right? They likely begin with a very genuine desire to understand what's happening. Right? What is going on here? So this is a wonderful question, right, that we can ask. What is actually happening? Yeah? What's going on in this moment's experience? So a scientist starts with that curiosity, that desire to understand or know. So whether it's planets or the ocean or human behavior or gorillas or mechanics, there's a genuine interest and they engage in a process of discovery or learning. So my husband has been reading at night a lot of Neil deGrasse Tyson, who many of you might know is an astrophysicist, wonderfully curious, engaged thinker, and writes a lot for children. And he said his secret is that he never grew up. He remained a little kid who wanted to understand how the world works. And he said at the heart of every scientist, whether or not you do that in your profession, is this curiosity about how things actually work. What is actually happening here? Yeah, so at night, Corin, my husband, is I'm like drifting off to sleep, and he's talking about like black holes and dark matter and all of these things. But there's a sense of absolute wonder at the mystery of all of it, right? So being in touch with this can cut through a lot of our preoccupation with what one teacher of mine calls our teeny tiny territory, right? Which is the sense of the sense of me. So this this curiosity, this sense of wonder. My son the other night, after a very difficult week, in which we were all to some degree really stuck in the teeny tiny territory. it led to a lot of questioning and of my own. I'm prone to the delusion often in parenting that I'm actually responsible for another being's development. How many of you might share that? But so kind of going around in circles. And then again at night, my son sort of drifting off to sleep suddenly perks up and says, He'd been very kind of preoccupied, caught up, surly. He says, but isn't the most amazing thing in the end, it's like that we're even alive at all? Isn't that the most amazing thing? He's like, whether I had a really good day or a really bad day, isn't that just the most amazing thing? And he blew me out of the water with that. He absolutely blew me out of the water with that. So we both just sat there with that. And that continued. But there is this, you know, at the heart of our human experience, I think we can touch this wonder and curiosity of a scientist who, no matter how it's going, is able to wonder at the fact that we are here at all, sitting in a room, wondering about what it means to be alive. Yeah. So every scientist has to also contend with their own biases, attitudes, approaches. And one of the wonders of meditation practice is that we can study, as I pointed to in the guided practice, what's actually happening in a given moment, but also, and perhaps more significantly, how we're responding to what's happening. How is the mind being shaped by what's happening? How is our world being created by how we're relating to what's happening? Yeah. So there's that. But then at the heart of all of it is this empty, aware quality, right? Of not being able to solidify around anything, right? So the other models I was going to use, and I realize, of course, that we're not going to get to all of them, but the scientist, right? The artist who really engages with getting to know the materials that they're working with, or that process of tuning an instrument in which one you know, plays a note, plays a chord, a guitar, an instrument, and then listens, yeah? Listens for the result. Tunes, tunes, and then listens. Yeah. An artist creates something, molds something, makes something, and then steps back and looks. Yeah. Looks, resonates, relates, opens. And the third model is the model of the healer, right? Somebody who is able to keep these questions of suffering or where does it hurt? So the civil rights activist, in a wonderful conversation with Krista Tippett, asked this question. So Ruby Sales, the civil rights activist, also a theologian, keeps this question at the center. Where does it hurt? Where does it hurt? And so if you think about this process of asking questions, keeping in mind what's most important, and also coming out of the spin and the swirl, how the scientist might do that, by keeping discovery and wonder at the center. What's happening now? Yeah. What is this experience? that experience of the artist, which is really in touch with the changingness of the present moment's experience, moment by moment, that acts or offers and then is tuning, listening. Yeah. What is at the heart of this experience? Yeah. The question of the healer, right? And to all of us engaged in these questions of what helps alleviate suffering, we might ask as a way of keeping in mind what's most important, where does it hurt? Whether we're working with a body or a family or an organization or a system or a culture, where does it hurt? And what is helpful? What is needed? So all of these questions are ways of engaging our natural capacities for discernment and wisdom. They're ways that we grow and deepen in understanding. So it's not that we take on a new identity as the scientist or the one who knows, as the artist, the one who creates, or the healer, the one, the helper, the caregiver, the one who heals. Every time we start to take on a new identity, we're solidifying again. Right? So a way of not kind of forming or kind of congealing around anything is to continue to ask questions, to know what's helpful to keep in mind at any given moment. Yeah, and to engage that natural process of curiosity, inquiry, wanting deeply to understand. So, as always, there's a lot more to say, but why don't we just sit quietly for a moment and kind of digest some of that. So you might drop in a question, even sitting here right now, as a way of engaging, as a way of tuning, as a way of relating. So what is this experience? How am I? What is the raw data coming in? How am I receiving it? Relating to it? What is the flavor or the attitude in my mind? And then, what is the nature of this experience? We tune in a little bit deeper, might be able to sense, to align with. The aspects of nature that are always operating, yeah, this flux. Shifting dynamic quality, no matter what we're observing, knowing. No real center anywhere, no fixed point, no ownership. Oh, thank you. So, appreciate your attention and your practice tonight. And I'd love to hear any of your own questions, comments, reflections, this quality of wisdom. This spirit of questioning, it's an emphasis of some teachers more than others. Certainly found it very helpful in my own practice. Was this something that you utilize or practice with? Have you found it helpful? Anything? Yeah, please, come on up.
Hi.
Hey, Austin.
Yes, good to see you. Observation from the meditation, and then wanted to share a question that I often ask. In the meditation, somewhere around there, I heard birds fluttering, but it wasn't constant. It was fluttering, and then it would go silent. And just the contrast was really powerful to me. Like, mm-hmm. Usually when I hear the birds, it's almost like I turn away, and I think it's a constant state. But actually, when I was observing, it was fluttering, and then in unison, they would get quiet, and then it would come back like mm-hmm. a wave. And then I observed, I could let that go, but my thoughts were doing the same thing. Yeah. They were like arising and then passing away. But I said, these are my thoughts. And so there was like a reaction to it,
yeah.
Like a, I don't want to use the word clinging, but almost like a guilt, like, ah, get out of here. Whereas when the birds were doing it, it was like, oh, the birds are fluttering and they're not fluttering. And so then I started relaxing. I said, those aren't mine.
Yeah.
They don't belong to me. They're just appearing and disappearing and coming back, just like the birds. And
yeah.
So I softened that sense of what you just said there, ownership.
Yeah.
Yeah. So bizarre that I'm walking around like owning those things, but every other phenomena that's happening around me, I'm not doing that, and it causes less suffering. So just some something. Mm-hmm. And then the question I often ask myself, it's not necessarily related to your talk, but it's more about just in daily life.
Yeah.
What would it look like if it were simple?
Oh.
If I ask that question all the time and apply it to different problems.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the essence of this practice in some ways is simplicity, like a radical simplicity.
Yeah.
So I thought I would share that with the group.
Mm.
Thank you.
Yeah. And what's the effect when you do that, when you ask that question? How does it come back to something essential and simple? It brings you back to that capacity to stay simple and open. Is that right? Okay. Okay. What's at the heart? Yeah. Yeah. So beautiful. Thanks, Austin. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful. Oh, yeah. To say as they're walking up here, the Austin's inquiry around listening to the birds fade into silence, and the difference between observing our thoughts fade into silence. Because thoughts, there is a real heaviness to our thoughts. So there's the dukkha nature of it, right? The anything that feels like ours, that we're taking ownership of, responsibility, complete responsibility for, there's a heaviness to it. Ah, yeah, it has like a gravitational pull or force. But being able to observe that flux. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi.
Hey.
I'm Lucas. I wanted to share just kind of this thought or this observation that I had many years ago. I was, and it relates to this, to me, to this idea of trying to understand what is and what is not, like that, like trying to create that division. Although maybe in the opposite way, but I kind of want to get your opinion on this.
What was the last thing you said?
I want to get your opinion.
Oh, okay.
On this. I, when I was very young, or not actually not very young, but in my 20s especially and into my 30s, my brain was just on fire. Like I was just always hearing people criticizing me, as I don't think is too uncommon in this life, but it was pretty intense for me. And I had specific caricatures in my head at the time. And I distinctly remember I was in the Minneapolis or St. Paul in the Harmar parking lot. I was getting some Lian Chin, going to a class after work, and I had all these voices yelling. And in sort of this act of desperation, I'm not even going to recommend this to people, but I kind of want to recommend this to people. I don't know. this one particular voice, which was always always belittling me and always telling me I was wrong, I said, "You know what? I'm pretty sure you're me. And I want you," and I didn't really talk to it. I just allowed that voice and that persona that was in my head to just take over my senses, and just to assume to, and I said, you get to drive, look through my eyes. I'm pretty sure you're me, so you go ahead. And when I allowed that to happen, everything went quiet in my head, and I could swear it's the first time that had happened for so long. And I've been kind of journeying, like, 15 years since then, and following those thoughts and, like, what happened that day for me when I was finally able to get a little bit of peace. And then I found meditation, and my life started to turn around quite a bit at that point. I don't know if I was just growing up or what was going on.
Mm.
And realizing that all those caricatures in our head, even I'm talking to you right now, like, you exist for me only up here, and my brain is creating you. But that one of the key things that I found is that there's actually wisdom inside those little caricatures.
Yeah.
And when we're yelling at them, or when we're letting them yell at us, we're trapping away that wisdom, and we're not allowing ourselves to have it. But when you can relax and just understand that that is you, that it allows that wisdom to kind of like come into your life. And I was suddenly able to be empathetic to people at work. Mm. It's like my IQ went up by 10 points in the next day, because I was suddenly able to just listen to people, realize that everything that they're saying to me is me. And like all the interpretation, no matter what it is, like whatever tone I think I'm hearing, that's in my head.
Yeah.
And I don't know. So that's kind of the, you know, one of these things that you just like, I gave you 90% of all my thoughts that have been going through my head in the last 15 years. So you got the synopsis. But I do kind of wonder how that relates to the practice. And so that's kind of where I'm coming with my observations of myself. My, hey, maybe give it a try, but I don't know. Might not be a good idea. But with respect to the practice, that do you see any what correlations?
I tend to really trust people's process, and also I didn't mention it a lot tonight, but I often, when I'm teaching, and really invite people to experiment, right? Not to just kind of follow systematically what they think they should be doing, but to really experiment. So there's not ever just like one approach or one way. And I think things do unfold in oftentimes a kind of mysterious way. But it seems like some degree of what happened is that your resistance to that voice somehow shifted, and you were able to open to it fully. Like maybe part of you had been hating it, resisting it. But in the Tibetan tradition, they have one. I don't know this teaching well, but there's it's like whatever's plaguing us is like some personified by like a dragon or a lion, and one approach is to just put your head in the middle of the lion, right? So to some degree, it seemed like that, like a kind of like a surrender to that voice. And so what seems to come out of that is a deepening understanding that that voice was trying to help, which is something that I think a lot of people come to in practice. Whatever's kind of plaguing them in an obsessive and relentless way feels like they can only feel the obstacle of it, the challenge of it. And so for me, and I think for a lot of people, there's a shift that comes when you realize, oh, whatever pattern is or program is playing out, it may be very misguided or doesn't have all the information, but it's actually trying to help keep me safe, trying to help. So you're right that there can be like a kernel of wisdom and certainly some energy trapped in there. So we'll talk about energy next month, so that when we stop resisting it, we actually have access to more of that energy and perhaps a kernel of the care and wisdom that's in there.
Thank you. And then I just the last thing, and I'll sit for this, but do you ever think it's all too much, like the 10 everythings and the fives of this and the tens of this, for like the for the practice, which is supposed to be like the simplest thing that you ever do? And if we're never supposed to think, how are we supposed to deal with like the lists at the same time? And I'll take that one offline. Thank you.
Yeah, that's good. So then you can talk to Austin, whose question is about simplicity. Yeah. Yes. I think whenever we notice that kind of mind of like that, all, it's all too much mind, which we can notice in a lot of different ways. The practice is one of letting go. It's not of like trying to get it all to fit together, try to hold anything together. Try, you know, it's one of deep simplicity and letting go. So keep your own questions that remind you of what's at the heart. Keep loyal to those, right? Because that'll have your own curiosity, your own care, and your own understanding. Yeah. So there's, you know, that kind of gotta get it all. It's all too much. That's the discursive mind trying to hold it all together. And Einstein said something like the problem can never be solved at the same level of consciousness that created the problem, right? So let the mind get really frustrated. Ah, I'm not getting it. Can't get it. So if we can remember that gesture of letting go, that gesture of interest, curiosity, and certainly that gesture of care, which care is what keeps us in there. Yeah, it's what keeps us engaged. Questions.
Hello, Carrie. Okay. I have a question. I have a question.
Oh,
I put
excited
in
to hear your voice after this dog. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question that I put in chat window. I don't know if
you
can
see
it.
Have a question still, Edmund?
Yes. Can you see in the chat, in meeting chat window?
I can hear you. Yep.
Can you see that question in the meeting chat window?
Oh, okay. What I read in the meditation, during the meditation?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking? Okay. So that comes from Toni Packer. She was a Zen practitioner for many years, trained by Philip Kaplow, I think. And then she left that tradition to try to become more simple. And she started a process and a practice of inquiry. So asking questions and then remaining silent, trying to kind of sense her way into not so much answers, but into greater understanding. So it isn't a poem. It was part of one of her books called, I think, The Silent Question, something like that.
Is it possible to get that text somehow?
Yes. So if you want to email me, I can send it to you.
Okay.
My information's on the website. Feel free, and I'll be happy to send it to you. Because I don't know if I can find it exactly in the book.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Happy to hear your voice. Okay. Maybe time for one more. Iris, do you have a question?
Thank you, Carrie. Wonderful talk. Your question earlier about how much does one use investigation and inquiry in practice. And yesterday there was a celebration of Joseph Goldstein's 80th birthday.
Oh, right.
From IMS. And it was really a joyous, wonderful occasion. And so it was about, of course, all things Joseph. And one of the things that has been really important to him in his practice of 60 years is questioning and inquiry and investigation. So I sort of you know, and that's not something that I do enough of. And so I will, you know, take this to heart. And the other thing I just wanted to say, I love the idea, you know, and you introduced it early in the talk of, you know, we don't have to go out and find wisdom. You know, that's not the way it works, you know, but just to kind of relax and not get so tied up with the teeny tiny self and, you know, keep practicing and so on and so forth. And wisdom arises that I don't have to do it, you know. So I love that relaxing kind of energy with the practice and awareness and so forth. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Iris. Yeah. Thank you. Right. I really appreciate everybody's comments and sharing tonight. Really, really meaningful. Thank you.